Okay, good morning everyone, and welcome to another week of Personal Growth Unlock based on the book The Gift. Today we're going to be doing the Prison of Rigidity. But first, let's just, as we always do, just let's review a little bit from last week. Last week we did the chapter The Prison of Unresolved Grief, where Edith Eger discussed the concept that the process of real grief is really a model of all disappointments in life. Is there sound now? Is everyone, can someone give me the, someone said, oh, thank you, okay. So the process of grief is a model for all disappointments in life. And we talked about the idea of Simchat HaChaim. Some people are just very positive people. They're able to see beyond the thin fog and they can see through it and see the majesty of life. Some people are not. However, often what happens is there's an unhappiness or an unsettledness which happens within people that needs to be looked at a deeper level and to understand why a person is so unhappy. So we talked about that process of three steps. One is identify why we're feeling unsettled or fragile, then express it, identify the feeling, then express it to others, to ourselves, and then go through a process of healing. And we talked about what she explains, that all grief, all therapy, she said, is about grief, because grief is not only about what happened, but it's about what didn't happen. And therefore, since life is all based on expectations, and most of our unhappiness has to do with expectations not being met, so there's always a process, even on a very small level, but there's always a process of grief. And therefore, it's about giving up control, as we explained. It's about Yeridat Tzorech Aliyah, which means that not only do we have to go through the process of grief to be able to cope with it, but also understanding that any failure, any disappointment, any loss of expectation can also has to be looked at as divine providence and be able to emerge from it in a much, much greater way. I don't know if any of you got to hear Edith Eger last night at the AJFM forum. She spoke a lot about becoming stronger out of pain, and it was very, very beautiful. She's an incredible person. And to use her words from last week's chapter, she says, in my experience, grief brings us together or it pushes us apart. In other words, any challenge in life, and particularly this concept of grief, can make people further apart. But if we use it properly, if we give it meaning, if we come through stronger, then we're never the same, but we can be better, not worse. Okay. Today we're going to do a very, very important topic, because I think it's really at the heart and at the foundation of personal growth. And it's the chapter which she calls The Prison of Rigidity. So on a general level, I think it's true that some people are more rigid than others by personality. Being flexible or being rigid is very much a chesed and gvura thing, as we've talked about in the past. So chesed people are sort of more expansive, more flexible, can go from one thing to another. Rigid people hold back, get themselves into boxes. Much more gvura thing. However, when we talk about the prison of rigidity, and we're going to come back to this a little bit later, I think we're not only talking about being flexible as opposed to being rigid, because what I'm going to submit to you is that some people are rigid in their flexibility, if that makes sense. In other words, they're rigid in their personality. And because their personality is so flexible, they're not even rigid where they need to be rigid. So being rigid or not being rigid is not just about having the nature of rigidity or flexibility. And it certainly helps if you've got a nature to be more flexible. It does help. But it's not just about that. It's about not boxing ourselves in something we've talked about so often, not boxing ourselves into anything. Okay. And that's, as I said before, that's at the heart of personal growth, because growth, the essence of a human being is to grow. Right? We've talked about this many times. What sets us apart from angels is that the fact that we could grow, that we're not in a box, that we're not limited by how we were created. So therefore, as human beings, the cornerstone of being, the brand name of being human, is the ability to grow, the ability to be as I've used the term before, within ourselves, sort of infinite. In other words, go beyond who we are through the neshama, through the life force which is godly, which is within us, whatever the case is. But bottom line is that the brand of who we are is flexibility, but often needs us to understand that flexibility means to go beyond who we are, and therefore it means also not to be rigid in flexibility either. So we need to explore that a little bit, and we'll come back to that. So in her book, in this chapter, Edith Eger, the author, talks about rigidity in the beginning of the chapter in the context of conflict. So I'm going to read you some of the paragraphs she says, and then we'll go into it a bit. So she says, when a couple tells me they never fight, I say, then you don't have intimacy either. Conflict is human. When we avoid conflict, we're actually moving closer to tyranny rather than peace. Beautiful line. Conflict itself isn't imprisoning. What keeps us trapped is the rigid thinking we often use to manage conflict. In other words, her point is that when we encounter conflict or difference or challenges that create conflict or create struggle, avoiding them is ineffective. Managing them is effective, but the only way to manage them properly is to let go of the prison of rigidity. So conflict is good. If you avoid it, you're actually losing out on depth that can happen only through conflict. But the critical thing is, how do we manage the conflict? And the difference, it's about managing it through not being rigid and not being trapped in rigid thinking. I just want to apologize. It seems like as we're giving this talk, someone, I think a neighbor, decided to do some construction while we're doing it. So we hear a bit of noise in the background. I hope it's not too distracting. So she continues, she says the following. The prison bars of rigid thinking can be hard to recognize because they're often gilded in good intentions. Listen to this. Many people seek me out for therapy because they want to improve their relationships, to find a better way to communicate with their partners or children, to have more peace and intimacy. But often I discover that they're not in therapy to learn how to negotiate conflict. They want my help in convincing others to conform to their point of view. If you come in with an agenda, if you're keeping score, trying to change someone else, then you're not free. Freedom is when you embrace your power to choose your own response. My patients say it all the time. I want him to, ... Or I want her to, ... But you can't want something for another person. You can only discover what's right for you. This really resonates. I think it's so true. I mean, I've had this, as I always say, I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist, but I do talk to people. And I've often had this when people come to me, and really it's to strengthen a relationship, but it's about how to get the other person to change. And if we've said a million times, you can't change the other person, you can change yourself. That change within yourself that can then inspire other people to shift. By the way, it's not only marriages or relationships. I have just had this recently with some parents who came to me for parenting advice, having a lot of challenges with their children. And I suggested changing themselves. And I often say to people that parenting is a process of a self-growth journey, a personal growth journey, because it was clear to me that some of the rigid way of parenting and some of the unmovable, not negotiable things that were happening in the house were causing toxicity and concerning tension. And I suggested some changes, and it was very hard. I could see how hard this is. It was really hard for them to come to me sort of, how can they get their child to change? And to hear that if you want your child to change, probably a good idea to start with yourself. And it could be really hard. But we work through it, and hopefully there'll be some good results. But it's so right, this, because it's all about what I want for the other person is not what I want. How do I manage that? Can we make this better? Can we enhance that? And it's really about starting with ourselves, starting with our own personal growth journey, which involves not being rigid. She says, this is one of the most important tools of managing conflict. Stop denying someone else's truth. Now, we'll talk about that soon. But it's basically about stop denying about the other person's viewpoint, perspective, where they're coming from. We really need to understand that. Freedom comes in letting go of the need to be right. Because maybe the other person could be right, or maybe both right. Now, as we know, as we know, and we've talked about this many times, people are often afraid to do this because they don't want to lose their own identity, which is a good idea. We shouldn't lose our own identity. We shouldn't lose our own individuality. And therefore, entertaining someone else's rightness, entertaining someone else's perspective, doesn't mean necessarily losing our own individuality, because it doesn't mean necessarily that we have to agree. And I want to just read a few more paragraphs, because she says something very beautifully. She says, it's what allows us to be assertive, which means not to be aggressive or passive or passive-aggressive. When we are aggressive, we decide for others. When we're passive, we let others decide for us. Beautiful line. And when we're passive-aggressive, we prevent others from deciding for themselves. So, in other words, in relationships, not being flexible and not being rigid doesn't mean I give in, but doesn't mean I remain stuck either. I relate to something else. I entertain an alternative. I hear different points of view. I hear my point of view as well. I hear the other person's point of view. We talk, we communicate, we relate, we connect, and we work something out. And therefore she says, the key to maintaining your freedom during a conflict is to hold your truth while also relinquishing the need for power and control. Now, as I was reading this, I was thinking of something that I learned in the Talmud. It took me a few moments to remember where it was, and I, with the help of search engines these days, it becomes fairly simple. But there's a piece in the Talmud which discusses, and this is where you see it so strongly, right? It discusses the disputes that used to take place between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel. Just to give you a bit of context, so because we will discuss later that there are some axiomatic truths that sometimes we do need to hold on to, but we'll talk about that soon. But let's talk about it just in the context of Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel. So there was a school of Shammai and school of Hillel, started by the two sages, Shammai and Hillel, two greatest of the great, who had halachic disputes, as we know, exist. Primarily not so much Hillel and Shammai together, but actually their students, which became academies, the Academy of Shammai and the Academy of Hillel. And the Talmud is full of halachic disputes between the two schools. Now, just to so you understand how halachic disputes work in the Talmud, actually both schools of thought, anytime you have a halachic dispute, till today, when you have a halachic dispute between rabbis who are following the halachic system, what is in truth happening is they're following the same system. They're actually following the same set of axiomatic rules and principles that highlight our belief and our surrender to the authenticity and the Torah and the truth of Torah, both the written Torah, the oral Torah, the divine revelation at Sinai, giving the Torah, and so on and so forth. Yet the way God designed the system, as he did every relationship, but in halachic disputes we have this as well, he gave room for different ways of thinking within the same system. So you can learn a piece of Talmud and there's a new question in halacha that comes up and there's a system to work out what the ruling is, and that system, that process involves certain axiomatic rules, but then also involves interpretation, and interpretation involves personal intellectual bias. So Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel argued all the time, and there's so many different laws about Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And then, of course, there's a system how to work out which one you're supposed to follow, and in most cases, we follow Beit Hillel. An example, just because we're coming up to Hanukkah soon, so Beit Shammai of the view that you light Hanukkah candles top to bottom, which means you light 8 candles on the first night, 7 on the second night, 6 on the third night, until you get to 1 on the last night. Beit Hillel maintain, no, you light 1 on the first night, 2 on the second night, 3 on the third night, and so on. The halacha follows Beit Hillel. So, the Talmud says the following. All right, that's just the context, the background. Talmud says, when the rabbis were struggling with so many halachic disputes between two schools of thought within the system of halacha, the system of Jewish law, so like, who's right, who's wrong, what does this mean? And a heavenly voice came out and said, Eilu va'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. Both of these views are part of the words of the living God. Meaning that they're both right. Because you can't have two rights. They were both right, because they were within the system. In other words, within the divine system, within the halachic system, they were both right. So then the Gemara continues, the Talmud continues, listen to this, this is amazing. The Talmud continues and says, if so, why is it that most times we follow the view of the Hillel Academy? Why the most times do we follow Bet Hillel in terms of halacha? Why does it work out that we paskin, so to speak, we rule in most cases according to Bet Hillel? How did that come about? Why did that come about? Says the Talmud, because the students of Hillel were kind and gracious. They taught their own ideas as well as the ideas of the students of Shammai. Furthermore, they even taught Shammai's opinions first. Amazing. So in the school of Hillel, the practice was that when they taught a topic, a halachic topic, and they went through and analyzed what we call a sugya, an idea, a concept, a halachic question, they always made sure in their yeshiva not only to teach their point of view, but to teach the view of Bet Shammai. Not only to teach the view of Bet Shammai, but to teach the view of Bet Shammai before their own. And in most cases, they didn't end up agreeing. They still held on to their own view. But in order to arrive at your own view with a lot of strength and clarity, it helps, it deepens the experience when you entertain the view of the others. And that's what they did. In other words, they went beyond their own halachic rigidity, so to speak. More so, apparently, than the school of Shammai did. And they still had their own philosophy of how they interpreted the law, which meant most cases, even when they bought the view of Shammai, they did not end up agreeing with them. They respected them. The Talmud tells us, there's another amazing part. The Talmud says that the two schools, they lived both in Israel. There were two communities, essentially, both following a different system of halachic ruling in a lot of cases. Yet there was the most tremendous respect between the two schools. And in Hillel's case, it meant that when they taught, they taught the views of Shammai, of Bet Shammai, before they taught their own views. Because it was so important for them to understand what is the view of the other. What is the rightness of the other. How to understand their view of being right, even though at the end I might not end up agreeing. And that just created an unbelievable relationship. And as a result, the Talmud tells us that the halacha most times follows Bet Hillel because that's what they did. So what that means is, in terms of, I mean, applying this to regular management of conflict in relationships, it means that effective management of conflict does not mean giving in necessarily, but it does mean understanding the other, understanding the perspective, the outlook of the other person as a possible alternative truth. That's what it means. Just disagreeing, which means disagreeing with respect, without criticism or without judgment, right? That's the way I define it. In other words, it means listening to the other, the famous Stephen Covey line, which we talked about at length many, many years ago. Seek to understand before being understood. Always important to listen, always important to understand the other, and to explore the other view as an alternative truth. To come to say, I understand that now, I get it. I don't agree with it, but I understand that that's another form of being right. And therefore, as I continue to disagree, obviously sometimes that also gives room for compromise or alternative solutions or win-win situations and things like that. But what it automatically does, when you listen to someone else and say, I don't need to remain stuck in my own point of view. I don't need to think that I am right and the whole world is wrong. But I need to understand an alternative and listen and entertain an alternative truth. What that means to me is I don't need to lose my identity. I don't need to lose my individuality. I don't need to lose my system of thinking. But it will inevitably result in my listening better, in respecting better, and understanding the other point of view, not just understanding it, but respecting it without criticism, without judgment, just respectfully disagreeing perhaps, or maybe agreeing. But it's even when it's disagreeing, it remains respectful. I mean, it's interesting going back to the system of Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel. You know, you think that if you really entertain the other one's truth, you end up agreeing, maybe sometimes. If you really, I mean, why? How come they always still didn't agree? And the answer is very simple, because they had a particular viewpoint of how to interpret halacha. I mean, to give you an example, in halachic disputes, most times Bet Hillel is more lenient, Bet Shammai is more strict. The reason is because Kabbalah tells us that the souls of Bet Hillel, the students of Bet Hillel, they were rooted in Chesed. The students of Bet Shammai were rooted in Gevurah. both good chesed, good gevura, which somehow influenced their objective thinking, but it somehow still swayed it a bit. In other words, they each had a legitimate system, process of understanding, but it's very different. I mean, it's sort of brought out in the relationship, is brought out in the book in an example that she goes, that Edith gives, that when her husband, and her were traveling in Europe. Incidentally, this is just a complete random fact, but I just thought I'd share it with you. She spoke last night, and I'm sure some of you heard it, as I said, and I learned something about her, which I didn't know, not so much about her, but about her husband. Because she said that when she had her third child, which was a son, her husband was very happy because he felt that the family name of Rabbi Akiva Eiger would be carried on. And then the penny dropped. So the reason why her name is Eiger, it's her husband's name, her husband's surname, is because they come from a very famous sage who lived about 300 years ago, whose name is Rabbi Akiva Eiger, one of the great Talmudists in Europe, an amazing, brilliant mind. So just a nice fact. It's interesting. Anyway, so she says that when she and her husband traveled in Europe one summer, they discovered a sort of a ballet performance or a musical thing that was going to pass by Paris, which was Russian. And Bella, her husband Bella, actually originated in Russia and suffered under the communists really, really badly. And they found that it was tickets, and he didn't want to go. And she went in, and she loved it. And she says, I came out at intermission, entranced by the performance, and encouraged him to come in for the second half. There are open seats, I said. Get a ticket and come enjoy this with me. But he wouldn't go in. I don't give money to the Russians, he said. Not after what the communists did to me in Czechoslovakia. He'd convinced himself that this was how he could avenge the cruelties and the imprisonment that he'd suffered. I argued with him, urged him to reconsider, and told him, these artists have nothing to do with what happened to you. But of course, I couldn't change his mind. I went back into the theater and enjoyed the rest of the performance for me. On the one hand, it's too bad he couldn't set aside his judgment and anger and sit with me in the dark, enjoying something breathtakingly beautiful. On the other hand, I can't say my way was better than his way. Bella's way was better for Bella. My way was better for me. And that brings it out just so clearly. It's not two rights. It's a perspective. You might come from a viewpoint, and I understand her point of view, very, very much in line with all her writings and all her viewpoint, which she takes to an extreme. She talks about getting rid of resentment, getting rid of hate, even the hate which we have towards Nazis and things like that. She really has lived her life trying to get rid of all this anger and hate. And from her point of view, she was going to go enjoy herself. His point of view is, no, I'm not going to support Russians. Russia was, and that's a point of view. It's worth debating, analyzing, discussing. But actually, it's two truths. It's two truths. Two perspectives, two alternatives. None is particularly more right than the other. She understood this. And it's such an important perspective, this, because often in relationships, for example, the rigidity of thinking can cause such discord, such arguments, such tension. When the one person, just for the life of them, cannot understand why the other person can't give in. As soon as we come to this concept of going beyond our rigidity, of understanding that there's sometimes more than one perspective, and listening to it, disagreeing with it, still maybe, but at least with respect and with understanding and exploration of an alternative perspective, then so much dissolves. Yeah, she didn't get to sit next to him by the performance. He had to wait for her outside while she enjoyed the performance, to use a simple example. And we have bigger examples, more significant examples, but it dissipates so much of the anger, and it becomes so much more respectful and so much more effective and manageable. I think I've shared this with you before, but Rabbi Twersky points out somewhere that the word in Hebrew for happiness is to be sameach. Sameach is to be happy, which etymologically in Hebrew is very similar to the word sameach. Got two of the same letters, which means to grow. When we grow, when we are not rigid, when we go beyond ourselves, when we explore and analyze a truth which is beyond us, or a different perspective which is as legitimate as ours, we are free. It frees us from that prison of rigidity, and it causes such an amazing happiness. Because it is growth. That's exactly what it is. It is growth. It is growth beyond myself. That's the beauty of relationships. That's the depth of relationships. Not to be the same as me. Not to only like things that are me, but to grow beyond me. To understand, to explore, to research things that are beyond me, as legitimate as me. That's growth. That's real growth. To learn from other things, other people. And that brings true happiness. So, sameach, growth, is the same as sameach. So that's the crux of this chapter. Now, we have to break this down a little bit because it's not always so simple as everything. Because rigidity has its place. And sometimes, even respecting rigidity is important. So, let's start with what we said before. Flexibility and rigidity is chesed and gevura, right? So chesed is the giving, the expanding, sort of everything goes. Generosity, it's going beyond myself, that's flexibility. Rigidity is more when I put things in boxes. This is the way it is, this is the way it's always been, this is the way it's always going to be. That's gevura, very much gevura. Now chesed and gevura, as we've talked about a million times, are particular definitions, particular descriptions. We call them in Hebrew particular kavim. They are certain viewpoints. They are different lines. You know, you have different train lines. You have different lines of personality. Chesed is one line, one approach. Gevurah is another approach. And we know, because we've talked about it so many times, it's probably the basis of everything that we've spoken about, that growth means never to be locked into one line. That is the essence of human growth. Never to be locked in one line. To revisit the fundamental concept that we are all created with, or most of us are created with, a disposition more towards chesed or gevura. And growth means to abandon that limitation and to be able to respond to both. To be able to incorporate both. To be able to have chesed and gevura, because chesed has good and bad, gevura has good and bad. And we can do it. You know how this is brought out so beautifully in this week's parsha and last week's parsha? Because we are taught that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, our forefathers, our patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, represented chesed, gevura, and tiferet. So the sages tell us, and the Kabbalists explain, that Avraham had one son that veered off the right path. The exact terminology used by the Talmud is Avraham yatsa mimenu Yishmael. Yishmael went out. Yitzchak yatsa mimenu Esav. Isaac, Esav went out of the path, of the Jewish way, of the moral way. He became rebellious, he became violent, and so on. Yaakov, Jacob, the third one, had 12 sons who became 12 different types of people, who became 12 tribes, each tribe being very different and unique and distinct from the other. And yet, mitato shlema, his bed was complete, meaning all his children were tzaddikim, all his children were righteous, all his children became part of the Jewish nation. We are all descendants of the 12 tribes, different 12 tribes. Some come from Levi, some from Yehuda, Benjamin, and so on. Why? Because Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov represented chesed, gevura, tiferet. Extreme chesed will always land up with negative chesed. Yishmael, the son of Avraham, the Kabbalists tell us, was the outcome of negative chesed. Because chesed sometimes has to be stopped. Gevura has its place, but extreme gevura is problematic. So Yitzchak is gevura, out of him comes Esau. Now it had to be that way because we first had to study. Avraham had to highlight what chesed means. Yitzchak had to highlight what gevura means. So it played out that way. But it wasn't until Yaakov, who was Tiferet, which is the synthesis, the combination, the intertwining between chesed and gevura, that created the perfect formula and therefore was able to have 12 children, which are all good. By the way, that's just an unbelievable parenting model. Parenting needs chesed and gevura, but life needs chesed and gevura. But parenting chesed extreme will be chaos, and some kids will just won't be able to handle it. Gevura in the extreme, a lot of kids won't be able to handle it. It needs both. We need love and we need limits. We need structure, we need acceptance. All those things, right? So coming back to this concept, therefore, rigidity in its own right is a gevura personality. General rigidity. To be rigid is a gevura thing. I'm rigid at this. I have to get up in the morning. You know, I have to be 6 o'clock. I can't talk to you because I'm 6:15. I've got to be so. All that kind of stuff. That's gevura. That's rigid. And normally rigid people take it to an extreme and it's annoying. But chesed, flexibility is a chesed concept. So real freedom, we know, to be truly free means that we're not stuck, we're not trapped in any description, chesed or gevura, which therefore means, as we began with, we're not even stuck in the world of flexibility. Because flexibility in its extreme is bad. In other words, we're not rigid in rigidity or flexibility, or flexibility or rigidity. That we experience the true flexibility, which is we can be flexible or we cannot be flexible. We can be flexible or we can be rigid. Why do I say this? Because this is a very misunderstood concept in the world. We talked about this a little bit in one way previously, but it's a very misunderstood concept in the world where people sometimes are so into being flexible and so into being tolerant and accepting that they become completely rigid in flexibility, and therefore start to be rigid and reject people and aggressive to people who hold different views, who are unaccepting in certain circumstances or appears to be intolerant in certain circumstances, right? Because you see, when we talked about Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel before, who were both very flexible, particularly the school of Hillel, although they arrived at certain conclusions, but they were always ready to entertain the view of Shammai. The flexibility lived there in the context of logic. In other words, we need to interpret a halachic process. We need to interpret a halachic problem. We need to work out something logically using the principles and the axioms of the way halacha and Torah tells me I need to do it. But in the world of logic, in the world of intellectual bias, there is more than one truth. There's always more than one perspective. The very essence of intellect, the very essence of understanding, gives room for different viewpoints. And therefore, in a relationship, for example, we talked about, you know, just that example that she gave. Should I enjoy myself, let go of my resentment, enjoy myself at a concert, or should I say I'm not giving any money to the Russians? That's a rational question. It's not an absolute, it's a rational question. And intellectually and honesty approaching this question, you will come up with more than one perspective, and they're both true. And that's fine. And the more we realize that that's true. And we might even, because they're both true, we might even come around in certain circumstances. There were certain circumstances in the Talmud even where, although they used very different principles, that Beit Hillel came around to Beit Shammai or vice versa. Not many, but there were. However, we need to also understand, as we've talked about before, that there are certain things that transcend logic. There are certain beliefs, certain convictions, certain moral values that in a Jewish context transcend the world of logic, and therefore they become absolute. And sometimes they give room for respectful rigidity. It has to be respectful, but it gives room to say, no, this is for me the only truth. And this is absolute truth with me, and anything beyond this is untrue. So to give you an extreme example, right? Just so sometimes it's always good to give an obvious or an extreme example, which almost doesn't make sense, just for clarity. If someone would tell you that it's okay to lie, it's okay to be dishonest. I'm not talking about the cases where it is okay to lie. I'm talking about just generally. Not being truthful is fine. You think he's a meshuggah? Maybe not. Maybe he's got a rational way to explain to you why dishonesty is okay. Right? I don't think anyone listening here today would tell me that dishonesty is okay. Integrity and dishonesty is an absolute value. Everyone thinks it's a value. But how about if someone would create a logical discussion and prove to you logically that dishonesty is okay? You think it's crazy. Why? Doesn't logic give room to two different perspectives? Doesn't logic give room for different viewpoints? And the answer is doesn't in this case. Why? Because we would all agree, I imagine, that honesty is an intrinsic moral value. And it's an intrinsic moral value, we're all pretty rigid about it. And if anyone comes along and tries to say it's not, then we just don't accept that. We might be respectful about it, but we won't entertain that. We probably won't have much to do with that person, because in the case of honesty, it's probably dangerous to have to do with people that aren't honest. But nevertheless, we can still respect them, respect their humanity, respect the fact that they are created in the image of God. It was something we discussed when we did Elie Wiesel's book. But it's an absolute. Because the reason that you and me think that honesty is good is not a logical thing, I hope. It's a moral value. It's a moral judgment. Now, in Judaism, to give the Jewish perspective on this, we go beyond. In other words, we say that there are many morals that are absolute because we have a belief in the Torah. And therefore, we have belief in what we call absolute morality and not relative morality. And therefore, they become things that are intrinsic truths for us. And sometimes not even understood, but they become intrinsic truths. And when they become intrinsic truths, it is not wrong. It is not wrong in those circumstances to say, I reject something else. In other words, within the context of my intrinsic truths, we need to be flexible. And that's something sorely lacking today among the Jewish community as well, where we have different sects or different people, you know, Hasidim, not Hasidim, Sephardim, Ashkenazim, and so on. And we fail to respect each other's viewpoints, which are really viewpoints about the same thing. But within the context of our intrinsic truths, we should be much more flexible. And we should understand Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel. There are different ways that arriving using the same system and arriving at different conclusions. And that is so lacking. And unfortunately, we need to do a lot more work to make sure that that happens in that level and in the level of just regular relationships every single day. But on the other hand, there are certain things which, while it's okay to respect the right of other people to believe differently, or respect the right of other people to act differently or behave differently, whatever the case is, but it's not wrong to hold on to those intrinsic truths as long as we do it respectfully. And it's important to make that distinction. So to give you an example from a Jewish idea, when Aaron, the brother of Moses, was commanded in the Torah to kindle the menorah, to kindle a candelabra every single day in the temple. So the candelabra in the temple, which we obviously celebrate at Hanukkah because of the miracle that took place with the candelabra, but the candelabra in the temple was kindled every single day of the year. It wasn't a Hanukkah thing. And it was beautifully made out of gold with seven branches. We are taught in Kabbalah that those seven branches represent seven different types of Jewish souls. Chesed, Gevurah. At the end of the day, although we all have to entertain both Chesed and Gevurah, but we have our different personalities, and that is fine. We have our own perspectives, and that is fine. And we have our own ways and drachim and pathways and journeys of getting through, of expressing and applying the intrinsic values that we have. So Aaron HaKohen, when we were told that when Aaron HaKohen would kindle the menorah every day, what he would be doing, spiritually speaking, he would be elevating, he would be kindling, he would be infusing each different soul with spiritual and divine energy to be able to express themselves. And there were seven separate candelabras on purpose, intentionally, to highlight the significance and the value and the greatness of seven different ways. There were 12 tribes, same thing. Each one had their own pathway, their own journey. They were different, very different. That's fine. But getting back to the menorah, how was the menorah made? It was made from one piece of gold. And all those seven branches had to then come and connect to the base. The base is the uniform values that everyone subscribed to, that every Jewish soul was expected to subscribe to, and then expressing it in different ways. The same thing goes back to the relationship of parenting. I've said this many times. I just gave a few parenting talks recently, and I emphasize this tremendously. That although that when we parent children, for example, it is critically important to understand that each child is different. And we have to let them express themselves in their own way. As soon as parents start to create clones of themselves and want to create uniform molds, it never works. It's ineffective. That doesn't mean we allow kids to do what they want. It doesn't mean at all. We give them expression to express within their personality. But when it comes to the core values, parents are responsible for instilling values. And therefore, when I raise a home and I have children, I decide what those values are. Those are my truths. And I expect everyone to subscribe to those values in their own unique, beautiful way, with their perspectives and their viewpoints. It might be very different to the other person, but they're all connected to the same value system. So there's a place for rigidity. When we say we shouldn't be rigid, we should not be completely abandon rigidity, because there's a positive rigidity which is important to hang on to. Our core beliefs, our convictions. Same thing with the 12 tribes. The 12 tribes were 12 tribes. That's why God designed the Jewish people to be in 12 distinct, different, unique tribes. But yet they all come back to the same patriarchs, the three patriarchs and the four matriarchs. They all have one root, one source, because they're all share common beliefs, common values. And then, you know, going back to how people build relationships. I often tell people when I discuss this with them, I say to them that, you know, we sometimes get attracted in relationships for sameness, but the depth of the relationship comes from difference. However, I do agree that when one explores a relationship, explores marriage, explores any relationship, right? Don't look for someone who's identical to you. That will make a very boring life. Look for someone who's different to you, so you can both learn from each other. But I always do recommend that people look for common values, shared values, because values are hard to change. Values, there's not that much flexibility. Values are values. Values are convictions, and they should be, because we're supposed to have values. Values play a very important role in how we live, as we discussed a number of months ago. Values are important, and therefore shared values can be important. If they're not shared values, we can work through them, but still, we can just respectfully disagree, even on a value level, but it's harder, because values are convictions, and values live in the world which transcends logic and rationale, where there's different viewpoints. Values are more inbuilt. In a Jewish context, our faith, our emunah, is inbuilt. It's not up to discussion. It's who it's what we believe in, and the values of the Torah is what we subscribe to. So I saw a very beautiful Kabbalistic idea on this. It was someone explaining how you bake challah. I'm not about to give you a recipe, because that probably wouldn't come out very well. But one of the key ingredients of bread, even from a halachic point of view, is salt. So much so that the Talmud tells us, or the halacha tells us, you know how on Shabbat we make a blessing on challah and we dip the challah into salt? There's a Kabbalistic a reason why we do that. It actually originates halachically from a different concept altogether. It's about that when we make a blessing on bread, it should have some taste. And the real obligation of dipping bread in salt when we eat is particularly got to do with a bread that was baked without salt, just flour and water, like matzah we eat on Pesach, right? And therefore we are told that we're supposed to dip the bread in salt to give it a bit of extra flavor. So in Kabbalah, it says an interesting thing. It says that lechem, salt, a bread, represents kindness, represents chesed. Salt represents gevura. Salt is strong. Salt represents the strength of the soul. Salt preserves. Very fascinating. The word for bread in Hebrew is lechem. The word for Hebrew of salt is melach. Same words, lechem and melach, because we need both. But here comes the interesting twist to this whole thing. You can eat bread without salt, but you can't have salt without bread. It's not edible. And when we do put a bit of salt to give a flavor, salt becomes almost like a secondary thing. In other words, salt becomes, just to give taste, it is very, very important. It's lacking something fundamental if we don't have it. But just focusing on salt will make you very sick. You need bread, a big bread, which has a little bit of salt. Putting it back to the discussion we are having. Lechem, kindness, is the way we entertain other people, the way we look for people, the way we connect to people, the way we learn with people and understand them, learn from them, learn to them, disagree with them, analyze them. Beit Shama, Beit Hillel, all of that is part of the bread structure. But we have to have part of ourselves that is rigid, our values, our convictions, which we hold within us. We don't have to broadcast them. We don't have to impose them on other people necessarily who don't have them. We don't have to get lost in our convictions, so it becomes the main part of the food, and therefore it clouds and undermines our ability to understand other people. We have to have it. Salt is an important ingredient, because every person has to have values, and those values are somewhat rigid. And rigidity in that context is a really good thing. But it can take over our whole life, that we can't even relate to someone who doesn't have those values. Even values that are very fundamental to us, even values that are intrinsic to us, even values that we believe in with absolute conviction, and that's fine, because we all should have a set of values that we commit to with absolute conviction, to the point of rejecting values that are the antithesis of those values. But that's within ourselves. We should not. It's like a little bit of bread, salt in the bread. We shouldn't let that take us over, that we can't even look at someone, and we can't talk to someone, and we can't listen to someone who subscribes to a different set of values than ours. So when it comes to things that aren't values, we have to do much more than just respect. We have to really listen and try and understand those values. when it comes to that, understand those perspectives. Beit Hillel wanted to understand Beit Shammai. Didn't end up agreeing, but he wanted to understand Beit Shammai. He wanted to understand Beit Shammai as an alternative truth. In relationships, we need to understand our partner or our friend or our whatever it is, ways of doing things that are different to ours, which as an alternative truth, not just as a value which you believe in and I don't know, something that is correct, just not my correct. When it comes to values, that's different. Values we hang on to, and we believe in it with conviction to the point of not exploring opposite values as alternative truths, because we have to have convictions. The set of convictions that I have are absolute truths that I believe in, and I do not entertain opposite values as a possible truth. I believe that they are not true. That's fine. I believe, for example, I believe in the authenticity of Torah, the eternity of Torah, and I believe with absolute faith in the 13 principles of my Maimonides, and I believe with absolute conviction that the Torah was given at Sinai. I don't entertain another view as a possible truth. I don't believe it's true. I believe there's only one truth, the Torah was given at Sinai. There's not a possibility that it wasn't given at Sinai, because if I thought there was a possibility, my convictions would be weak. And a person has to live with strong convictions. Emunah by definition, faith by definition, means you believe in something strongly. It's ingrained as part of your DNA. My belief in Torah from Sinai is absolute. I don't believe the opposite is true. I don't believe that if you come with a theory that the Torah wasn't given at Sinai, God forbid, that's an alternative truth. It is not an alternative truth for me. It is an absolute truth. But that doesn't mean that if there's people who perhaps choose not to believe in that, that I can't find great things within them. I can't listen to them. I can't learn from them. I can't respect their godly imprint with which they were created. I'm not going to explore their viewpoint on Torah from Sinai, for example, as an alternative truth. That I won't do. Nor will I give it any credence, or nor will I approve it, nor will I give it validity, because it goes against the very core of what I believe in. But that doesn't mean that the salt becomes the main course. That doesn't mean that we don't have common ground. That doesn't mean we can't listen. That doesn't mean we can't learn from each other. That doesn't mean we can't have a coffee together. That doesn't mean we can't learn things from each other, from personality, from character. There's so much. There's so much that we could. There's so much that will still unite us. So I wanted to make that very clear, because rigidity, the connotation of being rigid is a very negative thing. And being rigid, being a rigid person is annoying. It's a very negative thing. But rigidity has its place, and yet it doesn't have to take us over. It's like the salt and the challah. So there are certain things that we should, and I think that the world lacks this nuance, because the world finds it very difficult today. Society today finds it very difficult to be nuanced, generally. It's like black and white for some reason. I don't know why. It's very, very sad. But that's an important nuance, that in things which we have common values, we're still going to be disagreements, but those disagreements can be listened to each other and understood as alternative truths. Outside of that value system, I don't have to entertain that. Rigidity is fine. I can be rigid in my convictions, and yet I can still relate, listen, learn from, and value the other person as a human being that has what to offer me. Very, very different. Abraham Avinu, we talked about this last week. Abraham Avinu, Abraham our patriarch, who was the symbol of kindness, fought with the whole society. Why did he fight with the whole society? Because he had an intrinsic truth, monotheism. And at that time, the society was pagan. And he refused to he welcomed every single human being into his tent, even pagan worshippers. But he did not entertain pagan worship as an alternative truth, because for him that was ingrained. It was a value. Emunah, faith. And he was rigid. The great Abraham, kind Abraham, generous Abraham, chesed Abraham, was rigid in his beliefs. And yet it didn't stop him from welcoming people, respectful to people, being individual people. Had he encountered someone that had him and, on the other hand, him and Sarah, for example, him and Sarah, who shared the same value, had disagreements. God said, you need to listen to Sarah, because she's got a different view to you. You have to understand her view as an alternative truth. Because you share the same values. Within those values, there are disagreements and there's different perspectives, and you need to entertain. So the entire society, he didn't entertain their views at all. He rejected them because they were against his values, and therefore he rejected them as an alternative truth, which is absolutely fine. That's the place for rigidity. as long as he was still respectful and welcoming to them and hospitable to them and generous to them and respect them and human beings, as he did, as we know. But when it came to him and Sarah, who were the only two people at the time that believed in the one God and shared that value, but they still had different perspectives, those perspectives, they needed to listen to each other and explore them as alternative truths. Just to end off, just something she says at the end of the book, which is really good, when we talk about not being rigid. One of the ways is, even when we see people who, even, I mean, this is like, particularly when we talk about people who are not lower than us, but sort of we can influence them or inspire them. One of the ways not to be rigid is also how we look at other people. Often we look at other people with judgment because we see them underperforming or we see them doing the wrong thing. Not being rigid also means how we look, not at other people's perspectives, but how we look at them. And we see them not only as they are, but we see them as what they could become. Rabbi Sacks, again, you know, a lot of study in Rabbi Sacks lately. So Rabbi Sacks mentions them and he says that one of the things he learned, he tells a story many, many, many times how the Lubavitcher Rebbe urged him to become a rabbi. And he says that besides the unbelievable foresight and insight and leadership of the Rebbe that actually really pushed him to become a rabbi, he said it was a transformative moment in his life because he saw that when the Rebbe looked at him and interviewed him as a secular college graduate from Cambridge University in London, he didn't see that student. He looked at him and saw a leader of the Jewish people. He looked at him and saw a rabbi. He looked at him and saw something that was amazing. So therefore, part of not being rigid, which he mentions at the end of the book, and I just thought we would be incomplete if we didn't mention that, was also that not being rigid doesn't only mean to entertain other people's perspectives, but it means even to entertain and analyze and explore things of that person that they're not even exploring themselves. To look at them not for what they are, but not be rigid and look at them at their depth, look beyond and see what they could become, another very important aspect of not being rigid. So that's just to clarify that concept of freeing ourselves from the prison of rigidity. It brings simcha, it brings joy, it helps us grow. It's a fundamental part of being human, but also to remember that part of that is not to be rigid in flexibility, but to know when there's a place for rigidity as well, and to explore that as proper part of effective human experience. Thank you very much. We're going to do another few weeks of this. There's a few more great chapters in the book. But for now, that's it. And have a wonderful day. And a wonderful week.